Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. We're going to continue our exploration of the cultures of consciousness. People have been listening to this show for a while know that I like to walk an interesting line between weirdness and sense. On the one hand, I'm convinced that there's remains to be a great deal discovered about the mind, about consciousness, about what lies behind synchronicities, psychedelic experiences, mystical states, the weirdness of human symbology, all of this sort of marvelous oddball area, and yet I remain fairly uncomfortable with most of the kind of accounts that people make to try to explain why these things persist, why they seem to have meaning. And so I'm also very interested in scientific accounts, skeptical accounts, reductionist accounts. And indeed, as I've said before, I really think that one of the things that is kind of upon us, especially if we're not completely beholden to any one reality tunnel, is to keep the dialogue open and as dynamic and even as intense as possible. And that, you know, the more you find yourself becoming convinced of some, you know, very unusual account of the nature of reality and consciousness and mind and the gods, etc., the more important it is for you to take a little time and spend some real thinking power encountering some of the reductionist accounts of the brain and how human beings perceive and construct their reality in a very grounded social historical context. And on the flip side, if you find yourself beholden to the kind of generic or even intensely intelligent forms of materialism that are rather pervasive these days, that you also owe it to yourself to explore not just intellectually but even personally some of these other realms of dreams and meditation and spirit encounters that clearly seem to persist for reasons that we can talk about. But the dialogue is an extremely important one, and in that dialogue, one of the things that we rely on, those of us who are not trained scientists, are popular accounts of science. It's an incredibly important and sort of difficult area of our understanding of the world. You know, we grow up in a scientific culture, and yet most of us aren't scientists. Or if we are scientists, we're scientists in one very narrow band, and regarding a great deal of the rest of science, we're in the same boat with everybody else, where we're kind of relying on popular accounts. And I think, like a lot of listeners to the show, I totally love popular accounts of science and newspapers, magazines, and books and talks and, you know, hearing podcasts and things like that. But it's always a tricky one, because there's this weird problem where, especially if you have journalists writing about the work that scientists are doing, and then there's all sorts of problems raised, how they're using metaphors, what they really understand. And on the other hand, if you read books, articles, magazines, talks by quote-unquote real scientists, people who are trained, people who can go deep into the arcana, the technical materials that would, you know, confuse most of us, that there's often kind of a lack of translation there. Or sometimes they will pretend to have more authority and assurance about what they're describing than they do. And sometimes you read books by scientists, you're like, wow, that's it. We know what's happening with the origins of the universe, or the nature of string theory. And then, you poke around, read some other guys, and you go, hey, it's actually much more complicated than that. You know, science is much more of a extended, grumbling conversation that often veers into argument than it is a sort of monolithic set of principles that everybody is kowtowing to. So in any case, this whole issue of books and hearing popular accounts of science is a really key one, and I'm very happy to say that this the new book by Christoph Koch, who's a very well-known neuroscientist, I'm sure some of you are familiar with his work. I worked for many, many, many years with Francis Crick, co-discoverer of the DNA double helix molecule, and his new book, Consciousness, Confessions of a Romantic Reductionist, is a great book. One, it's short, and I mean that in the best sense, that he would manage to pack in a lot of very tantalizing ideas, a lot of very interesting information, studies, ways of thinking about the relationship of consciousness to the brain in a very readable, excessively written format, but I also really love the way he brings himself into the text. It's something where a lot of books by scientists, they don't do this. They kind of put on their, you know, teaching the undergraduates hat, and they kind of go through and explain everything, which is great and can be illuminating, and Krzysztof does that as well. But he also lets you into a lot more about his own life, which is really important, because that's one of the things you always wonder with people who are studying the brain, studying, you know, really looking at what it means to be alive, to be aware, to be processing all of these different degrees of reality on the fly as we move through the world. Like, well, you spend all the time in the lab studying stuff. Well, how does it impact you? How does it affect you in the way that you deal with moral decisions, the way you deal with other beings, the way you think about God, the way you think about the nature of reality? You know, these things are really key, and his book is a really wonderful invitation into a really unusual way of doing that. He's not exactly he's not exactly a standard bearer in some ways, and that's one of the things we'll be talking about in this show. It has some very interesting, innovative ways of thinking about consciousness in reality. But before we get to Professor Koch, we'll bring on our co-host here, Maja Dawu, from Los Angeles. You guys are both kind of in the Los Angeles area. How are you doing, Maja?
I'm doing really good. I really like how you describe science as a grumbling conversation. That's very good.
Yeah, it's funny. My father is a scientist, and I learned so much by, you know, reading something in the paper about something that he did, you know, the physics of the ocean. He's an oceanographer, and then I go and I start to talk to him about it, and the variation between the stories and it's really remarkable, and really getting a sense of how things sort of work behind the scenes. I mean, you know, you worked in science as well, and you also dabble in the odd edges of things. I mean, how do you think that conversation should be going? How do you carry that out in your own ways of thinking about the world? I mean, biology and, you know.
That's the thing. Like, it's not happening like, oh, physics happens here and then chemistry happens here, but it doesn't happen in our body or in us, and then there's religion over here. I hate how people do that. And to me, I think it should just be carried out in an open, exploratory fashion where people can, instead of, like, thinking they have answers, how about just see, well, I wonder what would happen if, like, we do this? And, oh, look at this. Like, this is weird. What is this doing? Or, you know, and like you, I'm very interested in mechanisms for how some kind of weird experience could happen. Like, how does it happen? What is there in our physical, biological structure that can allow that? And I think a lot of, you know, scientists will say, oh, well, we explained why the near-death experience would happen. It's because of this chemical or this chemical. Well, why is there that chemical that makes that happen, you know? So, I just want to, like, look at and talk about that these things happen, and maybe we could get a little closer to some kind of mechanistic or even understanding of our own physiological way to provide for these experiences.
At least to extend the grumbling conversation.
Yes, exactly. Right, we should grumble.
With that, we'll bring on Professor Koch. Professor, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thanks a lot, Eric, for having me.
That's what, guy, you really do have this. You're an American, and you have this marvelous accent.
Well, I was born in this country, but then I was raised throughout the world, and so that's why I'm left with this robust Germanic accent.
I think it's quite delightful. So, you know, I wanted just to sort of throw out the bona fides. Professor of Cognitive and Behavioral Biology at Caltech, and you're also the Chief Scientific Officer of the Allen Institute for Brain Science, which I hope we talk about later in the program. And John Allen's a very interesting guy, sets up very interesting projects. I'm sure that's a very exciting place to be. But just to kind of start us out, I thought it might be really good if you could tell us a little bit about, you know, the core research you've been carrying out in terms of the neural correlates of consciousness and what you've really been looking at, you know, particularly this nitty-gritty, you know, level of nerve clusters and the relationship they seem to have with aspects of consciousness. Just to give us a sense of, like, where you really, you know, the real of your research.
All right, well, let's just step back. So how do you study consciousness as a scientist? And there are several ways of doing it. One way is you study consciousness where you see it most obviously, which is in people. And then you can study it using conventional tools like psychology. You can talk to people. You can, or you can do what Buddhist monks do. You can explore the inner world of your sensations, of your feelings. Or what you can try to do, you can try to relate that inner world with the outer world with the world at large, in particular with the world of the brain. We know there's this intimate relationship between the brain on the one hand and my inner experiences on the other. We know this because if you get hit hard on the head, your inner world, you know, your brain gets damaged and your inner world goes away. And so we know, unlike the Greeks, it's not the heart that matters or the liver that matters, but it's really the brain that matters. But then you want to ask, well, what is it? So there is this intimate relationship between the brain on the one hand and your consciousness on the other. But then we can now begin to ask more specific questions. Is it the entire brain that's necessary for consciousness? Is it only part of the brain that's necessary? Which parts are necessary? And what does that help us? Then we can explore what's different types of consciousness. We can explore consciousness that you mentioned. What happens when I dream? My brain is in a very different state when I dream than when I'm in a deep sleep. We can explore what happens under mushrooms or, you know, other agents. We can then try to explore what happens in pathologies, like when you have a patient, like you might remember Terry Schiavo a couple of years ago, the woman in Florida who, after an episode of anoxia, sort of was left alive but unconscious. There wasn't, as far as we could tell, although she was moving, she was grimacing, she was occasionally groaning, as far as we could tell, as far as science and medicine could tell, there wasn't any conscious sensation there. Well, what's wrong in her? You can ask, when does consciousness begin? What about babies? What about infants? What about newborns? What about a fetus? And then, of course, you can extend this, again, using these brain-based tools. You can say, well, what happens in animals that are closely related to us, like monkeys or mice or any mammal? They're very closely related to us, because if you look at their brain, if I give you a little piece of monkey brain, of mouse brain, or human brain, only a few experts can tell the difference. Sort of at the level, let's say, if I give you a pea-sized piece of monkey brain and human brain, it's very difficult to tell them apart. We have more of the stuff than a monkey has, but then of course other animals like whales have even more than we do. So we can try to ask, you know, about consciousness in these other creatures. And then, of course, in those other creatures, we can do sort of experiments that we can't do for obvious ethical reasons in humans, and we can really try to chase down the footprints of consciousness to the level of which particular elements are involved in the brain. Is it all the neurons? Is it a subset of the neurons? What do they have particular labels? Do they have a particular morphology? Do they have a particular mode of operating, like oscillation versus synchrony versus firing in isolated bursts? So this is sort of what the modern search for the material roots of consciousness in the brain is all about.
And then there's always the creatures without brains and how they exhibit conscious behavior, right?
Which creatures are those?
Like that. You know, like single-celled organisms or things that don't have like a physical fleshy brain.
Well, I mean, there are those fringe cases. I don't think right now, certainly for tactile reasons, it's useful to explore whether or not a single cell organism has consciousness. It's a very difficult problem, the mind-body problem. So our strategy is a very pragmatic one. Let's study it in cases where it's undeniable that there's consciousness there, particularly in people and in closely related species. And then later on, once we have a fully developed theory of consciousness, we can then ask, well, how far does it go down?
Right.
You know, is it maybe panpsychism is valid? You know, maybe everything has a certain amount of consciousness. But right now, that's a very difficult question to answer empirically. So let's a related question that people do, and I have asked, what extent are bees are conscious? Bees are very complicated creatures. They have a million neurons, roughly. Their nerve cells are 10 times smaller than ours, but they're very complicated. And, of course, bees have very elaborate behavior. They have their dance. They can recognize single faces. They have very elaborate procedures to look for the next nest. So to what extent is a bee conscious? I think there's a reasonable chance a bee is conscious, but empirically it's very difficult to approach it. It's much more difficult to study it in bees than it is in mice or in monkeys or in humans.
Mm.
So one of the things you talked about in your own research that really fascinated me was just how the evidence for the correlation of very specific and recurrent relatively or pretty small clusters of neurons with specific thoughts or images or characters, that you can take the sort of reductionist line, and you do a really wonderful job of kind of explaining why that approach is so valuable, even though it can, you know, create these other problems on other levels, philosophical, scientific even, that how detailed, how far down you can go and find these correlations.
So a good example is the so-called Jennifer Aniston neurons after the actress. You can Google them. They're all over the web. So we work since many years with a neurosurgeon, Dr. Isaac Fried at UCLA, and he implants patients. So these are epileptic patients, and the patients have lots of seizures, and they can't be controlled by drugs anymore. The drugs don't work anymore. And then one procedure is that you try to identify the foci, if there is a single foci, a single place in the brain from which these seizures, you know, these hypersynchronized electrical discharges that then engulf the entire brain and then give rise to these very dramatic, you know, epileptic attacks. So you try to identify where that foci is and then remove it surgically. In some people, you can do that from the outside, but in some patients, you need to implant microelectrodes into the brain, leave those microelectrodes there for, you know, a couple of days in order to detect, and then you monitor them 24/7, and then sort of you can do triangulation and pinpoint where exactly sort of is that faulty part of the brain that gives rise to these discharges, okay? So in principle, this now gives us the opportunity with the consent of the patient. We let them, for example, play very simple video games. We show them various images, and now we can listen in to individual neurons chatting away. And the way individual neurons talk, the way they chat, is they have this staccato, these pulses. So they communicate the universal language that all animals use, almost all animals use to communicate, the nerve cells communicate with each other with these pulses. So we can monitor these pulses. And then, for example, we can show the patient different images, and if the patient doesn't know these images, these are, let's say, people. I show them faces of people or animals or famous buildings or things like that. And most of the time, the neuron will just fire occasionally. But then if you show, so the first time we found this was for then President Clinton. We showed this one to this patient, different images of President Clinton, the cell would always respond very consistently. Every time I show the image, the student would show the image, 300 to 400 milliseconds later, the cell would fire. We found this, and so this is also how we found this Jennifer Aniston cell. You can show very different pictures of Jen, and the cell will respond to it. Some of these cells would also respond if you give the name, you know, if you give the name Jennifer Aniston, or if you have a computer, say, with a computer voice Jennifer Aniston. So it's a very specific neuron. And, of course, it's not one. We're only listening to one, but they're probably going to be a couple of thousand of them. And it doesn't respond to other blonde women. It doesn't respond to other actresses. It responds very specifically to Jennifer Aniston. And the belief, our hypothesis is that if you think about Jennifer Aniston, if you dream about Jennifer Aniston, if you imagine something about Jennifer Aniston, these sets of neurons are the substrates of your thought of Jennifer Aniston. Like the platonic idea of Jennifer Aniston in the head of this patient is represented by these sets of neurons.
And what's the nature of the pulse? Is it like just electrons? Is it light? Is it electricity? Like what exact? I mean, when you say pulse,
it's a change in membrane potential. I mean, this was discovered roughly 100 years ago. People have studied it in great detail. It's an electrical discharge that travels along these axons and the nerve fibers. It's roughly half a millisecond wide. It's roughly 100 millivolt, a tenth of a volt in amplitude. And like I said, it's a pretty universal code that almost all nervous system use to transmit information from one neuron to the next. It's a very secure, as every digital electrical engineer can tell you, it's a relatively secure way to transmit information to encode it in pulses.
So from this perspective of these very specifically targeted neurons, now that's not consciousness itself. That's sort of an aspect of the system, but there's a need to build a kind of larger, more global account of how these different things are talking to each other, because you can, of course, imagine a creature that has whose neurons respond when they see an image of Jennifer Aniston, but they're not conscious of it, they're not aware of it, it doesn't sort of enter into this like larger circuit. So how do you get from these very specific studies where you're like, wow, there's just unquestionably very specific neural correlates of, you know, thoughts, images, you know, conscious experiences. And then from that, how do you then build up towards a more global account that might really be able to explain or at least create a model for how consciousness happens across the brain?
Well, Let me tell you a story. So I'm doing this since 25 years studying consciousness, and probably a decade and a half ago I gave a talk somewhere on sort of some signals in the brain that Francis Crick and I had postulated at the time were closely related to consciousness, so-called Fourier oscillations. Sometimes neurons fire in this very rhythmic way, this where they fire on average, you know, 40 times a second, every, like, say, 20, 25, 30 milliseconds. And at the time we thought, and there was some reason to believe, that this sort of was a hallmark of consciousness. And then I gave a talk in Switzerland, and somebody at the end said, well, this is all very fine, and let's assume your theory is true, you and Francis Crick's theory is true, and it's, and, you know, 40 hertz oscillation in this subset of cells, in this part, in that part of the brain, is the hallmark of consciousness. How is that different from René Descartes in 1642 saying it's the pineal gland? You might know that, you know, René Descartes, sort of the father of sort of the modern mind-body problem, he postulated that because consciousness is unitary, I don't have two conscious accounts in my head, I only have one, yet everything is, I have copies of everything, I have two copies of everything in my head. I have a left brain and a right brain, and everything is symmetric. So he was looking for a single unitary structure, and he said that unitary structure probably is where consciousness happens. So in modern language, he would say the neural college of consciousness in the pineal gland, that today we know is totally wrong. So this guy asked me, well, how is your idea different from René Descartes? In both cases, we have to take it as an article of faith, that just like, the, you know, you rub a brass lamp and then a genie appears. So here you claim that once, you know, you have excitable matter in this state, 40 hertz state, then magically you get feelings. Well, That seems to be non-sequitur. There's a big explanatory gap. So what you really need, you need a foundational theory. So on the one hand, you need to do these neuronal studies, and they're very popular, and many people do it. You need to explore where, in which part of the brain does consciousness reside. But then what you need a theory. That you need, as you say, an account that tells you why is it that these neurons firing together in this particular way, or these molecules, or what you know, whatever you think it is, why is it that this gives rise to consciousness? And so the account that I favor is a so-called information theoretical account. It's a dual aspect account where you say fundamentally what consciousness is. It's a particular type of information that's both highly differentiated, which means you can express many, many different things in it, and it's also integrated, because one thing we know about our conscious experience there, whatever experience I have is a unitary experience. I have a single experience. When I hear your voice, I hear your voice as a whole. When I look at somebody, I see his or her face as a whole. I can't, let's see the color separate from the eyes. I can't see the left hemisphere, the left hemifield separate from the right hemifield, unless, of course, I cover it up. It's this unitary, holistic aspect of consciousness that philosophers have much remarked upon. You take those two properties and you say, well, ultimately what consciousness has to be, it has to arise from a physical system, but it has to be very closely associated to this particular type of information. It's both integrated and differentiated.
Well, the studies of examples of people that have experiences that are not integrated, where, like, say, their consciousness of an experience of, like, hearing your voice splits into separations. Are there any studies that have done on people that have, like, an experience like that in their neurons that is separated? Has anything like that given any clues to finding that spot where the integration happens?
That's a good question. So, of course, there are artificial agents under which you can induce this dissociation. You know, LSD does it sometimes, right, when you get ego dissolution, and ketamine, vitamin K, you know, sometimes it's abused as a street drug, does that. And, of course, there are some clinical people who are in this very florid state of dissociation. So people are trying to use patients or experimental subjects like that to dissociate. The trouble is it's a little bit difficult because the dissociation can happen very fast.
Mm.
You know, can happen in fractions of a second. So the claim would still be for a fraction of a second you have this one experience, but then in these people when they take drugs or have this medical condition, it very rapidly switches every couple of hundred milliseconds. In you and me, it's very stable. You know, I have this the entire day. I have this feeling of I have an ego. Right? I mean, this is, it's so basic to us, we cannot imagine really what it's like to be without an ego unless, you know, you take LSD or something like that. But in these people, they don't have that. It constantly flitters about. And the claim is that the neuron that sort of these neural collisions will reflect that. They'll have smaller neural collisions than you and I, and they constantly flit about in different parts of the brain. But that any one conscious experience, even these people, although it might be impoverished, they might be conscious of much less in this condition, will still be a unitary experience.
Mm.
There's another aspect of this that this raises in terms of topics you talk about very well and very interestingly in your book, which is that right next door to the sense that our consciousness has this holistic element where we're having one experience, there's this kind of series of experiences that within which our egos remain apparently continuous, and there's that really strong sense of binding and almost kind of fusion of all of our experiences. But at the same time, there is this thing that people have called the unconscious. And we might have understood that one day long ago with Freud talking about these sort of impulses and concepts and stories that we see traces of in our dreams and traces of in the sort of pathological and absurd things that we do in our ordinary days. And, people kind of look, well, that's okay, those are interesting, stories back from the turn of the last century. But you offer also a very interesting account of this unconscious realm, because some of the kinds of experiences that we talk about in the show with paranormal things, et cetera, can really be understood as aspects or even seemingly intelligent aspects of our unconscious that somehow arise or mark themselves into our conscious lives. And you really address that in a very interesting way, talking about the zombie army and these sorts of things. So I'd love to hear how you kind of balance the account of the unconscious with the sense of the unified nature of our conscious experience.
Well, so, I mean, the difference to the conscious is that the unconscious is not unified. So you have many, many parts in your brain that do not give rise to consciousness, some because currently you're not attending to them. Let's see, you can in principle shift your attention to your little toe, right? You can do it right now as we speak. I can shift my attention to my little toe. I can wiggle it and I can feel it inside the sock, inside my shoe. But usually you don't. But then there are many parts. In fact, I would probably say the majority of parts of your brain cannot be accessed by consciousness. The neural mechanisms are just not evolved to access all parts of your brain. So, for instance, we know you don't see with your eyes, because if you would see with your eyes, you would, for example, see a hole. It's called it's a spot at the where the optic nerve leaves the eye, and you can detect it, right? You can close one eye and then move one finger into it, and you can see there's actually a spot there where you don't see anything. Yet your brain fills up, your higher order brain fills in that empty spot. If you were to see with your eyes, you would, for example, your eyes move about 3 to 4 times a second, so you would tend to throw up, right? If you look at the move, if you actually would see what your eyes see, it would be so incredibly jerky, you would get this feeling of nausea. So it's just one example of one part of the brain that consciousness doesn't access. There are many parts of the brain, particularly all the parts of the brain like the amygdala that give rise to to emotions. You're confronted with this emotion, you like this person, you hate this person, you have this feeling of disgust when you met a third one, and you don't really know why, and you try to sort of understand why, and you can try to reason, you can talk to your friends, you can go to a psychoanalyst to try to understand it, but fundamentally your brain doesn't give you access to that. You can only infer what happened from that using this indirect inference method. But the fact of the matter is you have all these different parts of your brain, they're not integrated, that's what makes them unconscious, yet they profoundly influence every day of your life, all your action. That's what you said. Very often we do absurd actions or we do pathetic action. We ask ourselves, now, why did I say that? That was totally unnecessary. But I had to say it. Something urged me to. Or why did I do that? I know this is not good, but I still feel compelled to do it, although I know it's not good for me. It's not good for my long-term, stability, etc. But you still do it. Well, because you have desires, and these desires might be unconscious, and so they prompt you to do things. But the difference with consciousness, once you have something in consciousness, you can reflect about it, you can think about it, and you can try to sort of to make plans, and then, of course, you always have to deal with the unconscious that might want to do things differently. And so you have to duke it out, and sometimes it's successful and sometimes it's not so successful. That's the storyline of our lives.
Okay, that sound indicates it's time for a break. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with Christoph Koch, and we'll be right back after this.
Well,
welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou. We're here with Eric Davis, and we're talking with Christoph Koch, and we're talking about brains and all the brain goo in your head. Christoph, before the break, you were talking about how we kind of have all this stuff that happens that's hidden from our consciousness within us, that's kind of inaccessible, you know, and this to me kind of brings up all those bigger questions of, like, if there's parts in us that we can't really control, who's controlling them, right? So then you get into the, like, who's driving this machinery, right? If we have, like, a spot where consciousness happens that we can access, that we can get to, what is making all the rest of the stuff go? I mean, is there, in part of your theory, is that just, like, instinct, or is there, like, is that where you get into panpsychism, or how do you kind of reconcile that part of it?
Well, it's a combination of different things. Yes, it's instinct partly. We are, you know, we all act out of self-preservation. I'm not going to jump in front of a speeding car, even if
right.
I wanted, even if I wanted to. And most of my life, if you think about the pattern of your life, much of what you do is done automatically. You know, it starts in the morning when you shower and you turn on the radio without thinking about it. When you, you know, wolf down some food, when you drive, most of those actions are, you're thinking about, you know, when you drive particularly, you're thinking about, you know, the fight you just had, or, the, you know, your upcoming discussion with your boss while your body takes care of driving. So most of the decisions are fairly automatic. Then, of course, there are the important life decisions, you know, am I going to move here or there? Am I going to see this person, yes or no? And there, again, it's a very difficult question. We do know from studying, from a famous experiment, that very, at least under certain conditions, when you think you've just made a decision, you can actually see, pick up signals in the brain before you thought you made the decision. There's a famous experiment done by Benjamin Libet where he has volunteers stare at a screen with a, on an oscilloscope where you have a little dot going around the screen. And he asked them, whenever you feel like it, raise your right hand. Whenever you feel you want to raise your right hand, just raise your right hand. And then tell me, where was this spot of light when you first decided, okay, now I've made a decision, I'm going to move my hand. And then you record the EEG, and you can see up to a second before there's a brain signal called a readiness potential that arises before you made the conscious decision. So at least for, in this simple experiment, and this has been replicated using also brain imaging, where it's a couple of seconds, up to 10 seconds before. So the, what this seems to imply, that certainly for certain types of decisions, these are of course very simple decisions that are not important to my life, right? When, you know, do I raise my right hand now or 2 seconds later? That really doesn't matter. But still, it's a very simple decision. And here you can see there are precursors in the brain that sort of give rise to my conscious sensation. So here what has to go on, something in your brain decides, okay, now's the time to raise your hand.
And was there any, like, experiments that test that part when you make, like, so-called unconscious decisions, like going to the bathroom, or, you know, the parts of yourself you can't control? Is there any way to kind of test a conscious response to those, or has anybody done that?
No, I mean, that's a question. I mean, how do you do that in the lab? That's a little bit more difficult to study in the lab. There's
right.
probably going to, you know, there's a threshold, you know, you have this urge to urinate, become stronger and stronger, and suddenly it overrides all the other plans you have. I mean, that's sort of fairly easy to understand. You know, any self-regulatory mechanism, you know, that's just like, you know, your car tells you by red lamp, you know, you need to put fuel in it. That's relatively easy to understand. What's more troubling are the decisions where I think me, Christoph, the little man inside my head, you know, the one that between my two eyes that looks out at the world, that this person makes a decision, okay, I want to do this. And then the question is there, am I truly free? And what does freedom mean? I mean, it's my brain that made the decision. It's not your brain. It's not my parents' brain. It's not my friend's brain, although they all influence me. Finally, it's me. But then the question is it the conscious me, or the combination of the conscious me and a lot of unconscious factors that I don't really access terribly well? And of course, the challenge for all of us, and this is, you can read the tradition, you know, I grew up in a Jesuit tradition, the Jesuit have this inspection of conscience, where you try, every time you make a decision, you try to think and reflect, particularly important decision, why am I making this decision? Is this really the right decision? So you try to the extent possible, it's very difficult, but you try to the extent possible to pull out all the unconscious factor and make them conscious. So you do obtain some control over them, so you're not just at the mercy of your, you know, of your unconscious.
So I have a question on that, because it's actually one of the parts of your book that I found most interesting. And again, you know, I really appreciate the way that you brought in some of your own life experiences. And you're talking about some of the, towards the end of the book, about some of the difficulties with your marriage and some, you know, heavy things that went down in your life. You don't go into detail. It doesn't really matter. But you're talking about, you know, these points in our lives where we really have to take our decisions seriously because, you know, there's been, you know, strong consequences and things like that. And you're right, you have this one line where you say, events and predispositions influence me, but I can't hide behind biological urges or anonymous social forces. I must act as if I am fully responsible, for otherwise all meaning would be leashed from this world and from the notions of good and bad actions. And my question for you is, do you feel that that move, where you still, in the face of the possibility that the Libet experiment applies across the board, and that what our brains do is tell us stories about how we were agents of making decisions about things in the past that we didn't actually do, faced with that, the move to say, no, I am an I, there is responsibility, there is something that I'm going to get behind here and affirm, is that a kind of pragmatic conclusion given the realities of our consensus reality as human beings and in this weird experience that we're in? Or do you think that that's actually something that's going on in the brain, if we can make that distinction, that there is some kind of information process, some kind of feedback, strange loop, overtone that creates, as it were, a point of agency that in some ways does interact with our physical, you know, army.
That's what I believe. I do believe. So I do believe this from a scientific point of view, which then has profoundly pragmatic consequences. In other words, I do believe that to the extent that you can make any important life decision conscious, to the extent that you can uncover all the factors that influence you in this decision, and sort of try to think about it consciously and rationally, and then try to make a decision, to that extent, you become master of your own fate. To that extent, you are the captain of your soul. If you just sort of let drift along and let, okay, I'm just going to do, I'll see when I get there how I feel, and then I'll make a decision based on that, then essentially you're saying, I'm primarily going to be driven by my unconscious desires and fears and needs, and let it go at that. So agency really means trying to become conscious to the extent possible, which is, of course, only limited, to the extent possible of all the factors that are relevant, and then making a decision in the full light of all of that.
Okay, let me ask another question on top of that, which, and I've talked about this with a number of very different kinds of people, is that, you know, that whether or not you're a scientist or a social scientist, you know, there are all sorts of accounts of why that sense of agency is an illusion. You know, another reductionist, I'm sure you've argued with many, would say, no, Christoph, you cannot make that move, et cetera, here's some scientific evidence why. And at the same time, we have psychologists, sociologists, whatever, talking about how when we think we're making decisions, we're just running on these narratives or impulses or whatever. So there's a lot of people out there who would contest your account. My question is, it's a slightly different one, which is that how much do you think your sense of that, your answer to that question has to do with, there's no better way to say it, your temperament. That you always approach life in a certain way. You know, there's a kind of dynamism, a kind of enthusiasm, a kind of leaping into the breach that you talk about through your book. That's clearly, you can see it in your career, you can see it in your personality, the way you like to do things, et cetera, et cetera. And then next door, you might have a very dynamic person, but they have a different relationship to things. And so in a way, they have a greater tendency to have more determinist or, skeptical account of agency, or perhaps even some of your Jesuit background. There is a kind of, and you talk about the way there's a certain kind of Catholic framework, which while you've left the belief systems behind or the specific dogmas and notions, there's still something that's informing you, you know, or at least has informed you enough that when you raised your children, you decided to raise them with some exposure to Catholicism because you understood why it could help form individuals, and certainly Jesuit education reforms people remarkably, however religious they end up being. So I'm just kind of curious about that. How much of it is partly because you see the world in a certain way that you're willing to acknowledge or look for this more robust account of agency?
That's a superb question. Now, nobody can escape their own personality, right? Because that's the stuff it's like fish in the water. They don't see the water. So, yes, I'm probably more compelled to look for something like that than somebody else. But also, so that's true for each one of us. We all have different motivation why we do things, and we have different motivations, Karl Marx says, for how our work shapes us. That still leaves the ontological question unanswered, though. To what extent can we be free agent? And I would assert, and I know there are many of my colleagues who think differently, but this is what the theory says. The theory says ultimately consciousness is what's irreducible about a system. It's this integrated information. It's irreducible. Okay, by definition, it is irreducible. It cannot be reduced to its individual components without loss. Okay, and that this is the extent to which I am free, to the extent that I can bring all the relevant decision variables into consciousness and then in the full light of all of that, make a decision. That is the freedom I have. Now, this is a claim. This can be tested. It might be wrong, and I want to believe it because I'm partly the person you say I am, but it might be wrong.
Okay, I'm curious what you would think then if you take that and apply it not just to your personality, but like the yogis, and you turn it back on the unconscious parts of your body, right? Because yoga, that's a big theme of getting freedom and autonomy. Part of it is to consciously control the parts, like literally biologically, physically within yourself that you can't control, and that's kind of what they say integration is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what you're talking about is like the projectile part, where it's what we do outside in our psychological thinking consciousness. But what if, like, as a brain scientist, have you, like, is there any kind of studies that look at, like, what if our brain tries to consciously control the parts of our brain that are not specifically usually accessible? Has there been, like, any kind of things that look at that in terms of integration?
Yeah, so there are famous studies, for example, by Davidson up at Wisconsin. He works together with the Dalai Lama, and they have a series of monks meditating inside the magnet, and you can see quite unusual brain signal. For example, you can see these 40 hertz oscillations I mentioned earlier, much, much more powerful, much more modulated than in normal normal people. In fact, we are all meeting at the Dalai Lama. He has the Dipang Monastery in Mangod, India. A number of us are meeting with him to talk about these phenomena. So there's no question that if you do meditation or similar practices for many, many years, you can control aspects of your brain body that normally, that normal people cannot control. One of the most famous images of the Vietnam War is, I don't know if you remember, the burning, the self-immolation of this monk at this intersection in 1972, where this monk, I think he was like 60 years old, calmly, walked to the intersection, sat down in lotus seat, his Confederates poured gas over him, and then he himself lit the flame, and he, without a single sound, without uttering a single sound, he sat in lotus, and while the flames consumed him, till he toppled over dead. I mean, it's just utterly remarkable. So, so there's no question that some people can do remarkable things. I would still, though, claim that this can be. I mean, they do control their brain much more than you and I ever could and can ever hope to can. But I think there's a natural scientific account of how this does happen. But there is very interesting phenomena.
There's another aspect of this. I'm curious whether people ever bring this up. Is that some long-term meditators, east and west, have made the claim that there's a kind of awareness or consciousness that they have even in deep sleep, so that they're actually in some sense staying awake throughout their entire cycle, not just in lucid dreaming. And it comes up a lot. Like, people definitely talk about it. Ken Wilber is a contemporary thinker who describes this phenomenon. It seems unlikely that they're lying or completely, deluded or whatever. And that one's always seemed like, wow, I mean, like, where would that occur? Could you possibly see that? Could you see a trace of that in a brain scan in someone who's been who's in deep sleep. I'm curious whether that ever comes up in any of the discussions.
Not this particular point, but if it's true, then it will show up. It should show up, for example, in EEG. I mean, the simplest way is to see this as the EEG, right? What's very robust, we can see, in fact, that's how it was discovered. You can see the difference between deep sleep and rapid eye movement sleep when most of the time you dream. It's easy to see an EEG. I mean, even a naive person can see it. When you're in deep sleep, you have these very slow, very large rolling waves, roughly at 1 hertz called, or 2 hertz called delta waves. And when you are in REM sleep, you get a brain state that looks much similar to when you are awake. It's high, it's very rapidly, constantly changing waves. So you should, in principle, you should be able to see some of this in such measurements.
Another question that I had, just taking some of the earlier points about the irreducibility of consciousness farther, is, you know, in the, you know, you describe yourself as a romantic reductionist, and at the same time, there's a certain point, a turn in your book, where you talk about panpsychism and this idea that, in some sense, consciousness is an irreducible factor in the cosmos, and that there is some degree of it in all organizations of matter, and that what we see with consciousness could very well be, in our own consciousness, a certain characteristic of a very complex forms of matter, including their information structure, is really what allows the consciousness to become more robust. But in some sense, there's a little bit of it everywhere. And I'm curious, you know, how it's a real shift when you kind of came to that perspective? Was it an inclination you had all along? And then how widespread is that in the sort of more hardcore neuroscience world that you work in? I mean, I know it's a topic
very
of
little
discussion. That's what I thought.
So first of all, if you hold to an information theoretical account of consciousness, in other words, if you say, okay, ultimately what matters about consciousness is not the fact that it's brains, but it's the organization of those brains. It's the organization of the parts of the brains, the neurons. That's really what it's not the stuff out of which the brain is made that matters, but it's the organization. I think most scientists believe that. This belief is called functionalism, right? It's a function of the, you have some elements, neurons or molecules or synapses, and they have various functional relationship. And consciousness, just like memory and motor control and perception, arises out of the interaction of these very complicated atoms, if you want. The atoms of perception consciousness are the nerve cells, okay? So if you believe that account, that ultimately you also believe, well, if you can replicate this in a brain, in a computer, for instance, then this computer would be conscious. So ultimately what matters really is the informational relationship, the functional or informational relationship of these parts. And then you can see, well, there are other systems that have informational relationships, such as computers or such as, you know, all sorts of other things out there. And now if they're simpler, you know, like, for example, to go back to an earlier question, to a paramecium, there are lots of informational relationship in a paramecium, right? It's a single cell organism, but it has all these proteins swimming around, and they interact, they bind, and they cross bind, etc. So you can formulate that as an information theoretical account. And then you say, well, in principle, unless you postulate a random threshold, an arbitrary threshold, unless you say, okay, there's a threshold below which you're not conscious and above which you're suddenly conscious, if you don't postulate such an ad hoc threshold, then you come to the realization, well, wait a minute, this paramecium, in principle at least, might also be conscious. Now, maybe only a tiny, tiny, itsy, itsy bit, much less than you're conscious in deep sleep. Right? We just agreed that most of us in deep sleep, there's no memory, there's no consciousness. I go to deep sleep, I wake up 2 hours later, I have no memory of it, right? So maybe a paramecium is like that. And so then you begin to adopt a panpsychist account, but a very measured, a very quantitative panpsychist account. So I'm not saying a paramecium has the same consciousness as I. I'm saying there might be some phenomenal subjective state that the system that I call paramecium has, but it's so immeasurable small compared to mine, I can't really imagine what that is. And for all intents and purposes, it's really less than I am conscious during my sleep. But there is some modicum, some atom of consciousness in a paramecium.
So it's measurable by different levels or kind of frequencies, because that becomes a big problem, right? Because then you get into the what's alive question. And I know, like with Francis Crick in his book Life Itself, he looks at those, like, what are the information systems that would kind of tell us what is the difference between life and where does it come from, and how did these things start, how did DNA start organizing, right? And it's true, like, they'll look at viruses, like, you can look at a virus and that kind of is like a little alive because it's doing stuff, or then you can look at like mad cow disease, which is just a
prion, exactly.
Proteins.
Exactly.
It's so, just like so, a string of information.
Yeah, so ultimately, so it's graded, becomes just less and less and less, and at no point can you say, okay, wait, here's the magic threshold. But on the other end, you can clearly see people, you know, alive, and dogs are alive, right? And stones, by that measure, are not alive. And so with consciousness, it this sort of panpsychism also says there's this gradation, but in principle, you can find it in any complex system. Of course, it also says quite clearly that you should be able to build it in artificial systems.
But with stones too, just to correct you, there's crystals that reproduce and also contain information. So then you get weird there too. So you can
correct.
See it in different spots.
And in fact, as you probably know, some people, Cam Smith, for example, has argued that life before RNA and before the pre-RNA world evolved from these crystals.
Right.
And yes, you're correct. Crystals do have some degree of integration. They may have a tiny modicum of consciousness. But that's really more a metaphysical point of view, because from any pragmatic point of view, that is so little. Yes, some people believe that crystals are alive, but most of it get perfectly by with this thought that, crystals are crystals, they're stones.
Right. But scientifically, they do contain information, like that's what we make
Correct.
Computers out of, and
Correct.
They reproduce. So under those
Correct.
Two stipulations, it would count.
Correct, yeah. But it's a fascinating account, because now you come to this realization, okay, so we live in a universe that seems to be conducive to life emerging, right? We live in a universe where you have stable elements, where you have stable stars that shine for billions of years as planets, and so you get evolution going, you get this complex system, and then the theory says, well, complex systems, they will have this consciousness associated with it. So suddenly we find ourselves in this wonderful universe that's filled with that seems to have an arrow, and the arrow seems to go ahead with ever more complex structures that we observe in the universe around us, and these ever more complex structures will develop consciousness, and at some point their consciousness will become so complex, so hypertrophied, that they can begin to reflect upon itself, and you get self-consciousness. That's what you have in us.
Hmm.
And this is an ongoing evolution. You could argue, if you look at our planet with Facebook and social media, sort of now as a whole, we're beginning to be so heavily intertwined with the internet, they're almost now as many internet servers, a couple of billion as there are people. Well, at some point, you could argue that all of this collectively will also have some sort of consciousness, and so you get this, what seemingly looks like this ever-increasing complexity. And that I find a very beautiful and a very compelling point of view.
When in the course of your thinking did you discover Teilhard de Chardin? You talk about Teilhard in the book. Of course, a lot of people, a lot of solid-headed people think he's kind of a little flaky, but for a lot of other people, it's an extremely inspiring vision with one foot in a kind of, very cosmological grounded. He was a scientist and so it account. But when in your own development did you encounter him?
I read him, so my father was a great admirer of Teilhard de Chardin. I read him as a, adolescent, The Measure of Man and books like that. And then when I was doing this work with the scientist Giulio Tononi, who invented the theory, I suddenly realized, oh my God, this is exactly Teilhard de Chardin. He has this law of complexification, or he argues, so he was a great believer in evolution, and that's why he couldn't publish his book, because he was also a devout Jesuit. He couldn't publish his book was only published after he died, that he argued there's ongoing evolution, and there's this arrow, this ongoing complexification from simple molecules to large-scale molecules to biomolecules to simple organisms to more complex organisms. And he believed that there's consciousness at all these levels. And then he became very mystical, and he had this point omega. We're all striving towards this point omega in some way, when the entire consciousness, the entire universe becomes conscious of itself, and then he's somehow that sort of godhood. So that becomes very mystical. But I think as a patron, I think he should be the patron saint of the internet, because he describes what he calls noosphere. When he argues, he envisions in the not too distant future, when the entire planet is covered with these heavily interconnected network entities, which is, you can see today in Facebook and Google and all of that. So in that sense, he was very prescient.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up. I have one little thought for you. It'll be interesting to see how much of a mystic you might become. You have a number of decades left, so it'll be interesting to see. But Chris, thank you so much for being on the show. Again,
it was my pleasure.
Your book, Consciousness, is really a delight to read for people like me, and I think a lot of the listeners to the show. And also just let people know that if you go to Christoph's website at the klab.caltech.edu, there's a lot of interesting stuff there. So thanks again.
Thanks a lot, Eric. Thanks a lot, Maya, for having me.
Thank you.
All right, for me and Majid, all you out there, keep your minds open.